Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is a very, very special guest that I have on the show this week. Up-and-coming musician. Someone's going to make a big splash in the music industry. Paul McCartney of a band called The Beatles. Yes, that Paul McCartney. And the interview is going to come up in a second, but I got to tell you how I met him because it is and probably always will be the most surreal experience of my life. I meet him backstage at a TV show. I'm rounding the corner, going through the hallway to get to the studio, and I round the corner and standing there all alone in the hallway, Paul McCartney, dressed like a little 12-year-old boy, like a neat, nice little t-shirt tucked into his jeans with a belt, standing against the wall, you know, with his arms folded, looking up at the ceiling, chewing gum like he's looks like he's waiting for a bus. And he's all alone. That's the part that blows my mind more than anything. He was all alone, not an entourage, security guards, nothing, manager, not a parrot on his shoulder, nothing. And that combined with the fact that it was Paul McCartney, when I round the corner, like I couldn't believe what I was seeing. My whole world slows down. I'm like, oh my God, it's Paul McCartney, right? And then I'm thinking, should I say hi? Should I not say hi? I don't want to bother him, but it's Paul McCartney. And then I'm like, screw it. He's alone in a hallway, unguarded. He's like a gazelle on the Serengeti Plains. I'm a lion. I'm going to pounce. So I go over and I just say, it's an honor to meet you. So excited, huge fan, blah, blah, blah. And I shake his hand, start to walk away. And he goes, wait, come back, come back. And he goes, what's your name? I go, Paul. He goes, oh, Paul, that's a good name. I'm like, I'll do the jokes, buddy. Okay, you just collect your royalties and love me doing, and that's it, okay? No, he goes, what do you do? He goes, I'm a stand-up. I said, I act. He goes, oh, I love stand-up. We start talking about stand-up. He knew Richard Pryor and he's talking about going to comedy clubs, and he's like, you got a kid? He goes, yeah. I go, yeah. He goes, yeah, I got a kid. He goes, it's hard, you know, touring with a kid. And I'm like, yeah, it is. And I'm thinking, you know, my touring is a little different than his touring. You know, like, I'm my entourage on a tour, okay? And as I'm talking to him, I'm like, really cool. Like, on the outside, I'm like trying to be really cool. Like, I, you know, like, nothing's fazing me, right? But on the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney, like, out of my mind, like those girls you see at Shea Stadium in the movies. So as I'm talking to him, I'm getting closer and closer to his face, like inappropriately so, like super close, like inches, because he's iconic. He's Paul McCartney and he looks amazing. And I'm checking him out. And to the point I was so close, like he was leaning backwards as I'm talking to him. I was so close. I was like those chimps on the National Geographic Channel. You know, when they clean ticks off their mates, like I could have cleaned fleas off his eyebrows. I was that close. Right. So I'm like, okay, let me just end this, leave this guy alone. So I say, well, nice to meet you. And I start to walk away. And as I'm walking away, I'm thinking, this thought comes into my head. Paul McCartney should do my podcast because I love talking to people about process and the creative process, especially, and musicians, especially because I don't know how I can't make music. It's amazing to me how it's made and music and sounds and lyrics together. And if anybody you want to talk to about making music, it's this guy. So I turn back and I say to him, look, I know this is crazy, but I would love to talk to you about how you make music. Would you do my podcast? And he goes, yeah, sure. Just like that. Just like that. Now, you know, at some point in your life, there was this hot girl, hot guy you want to ask him out, but they're way above your pay grade. And you think, you know what? I'm going to ask him out anyway. They're going to say no, but at least I'll know on my deathbed I asked them out. Instead, they say yes, and you don't have a plan. That was me. He goes, yeah, sure. How do we do it? Now I'm completely thrown and I start rubbing my leg like Rain Man. And this is literally what I sounded like. I'm not making this up. I'm not trying to be funny. This is what I sound like. He goes, yeah, sure. How would we do it? I'm like, I'll come to London. And he's like, we're together in New York right now. Why would you come to London? And then he goes to me, is it easy to do? And I actually said to Paul McCartney, the most influential musician in the last century, oh, yeah, it's really easy. I don't want to be a bother. You're busy. You can do it on your phone, naked from your toilet. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I saying? I got to get away. I'm ruining this. So I said, look, I'll leave you alone. We'll set this up with your assistant. I'll find them, whatever. He goes, no. He goes, they're going to make it too complicated. You and I'll do it. I go, what? He goes, you and I'll exchange phone numbers. And when I call you, you got to be ready to do it, though. I go, oh, yeah, I'll be ready. No problem. So now my hand is shaking. I have a post-it with my phone number on. I'm handing it to Paul McCartney. He hands me mine. Now, I think he gave me a number for a Chinese restaurant, right? I don't think this is real, like, because he does this all the time. He probably, whatever, right? People ask him for stuff all the time. So he does his performance. The show's over. I'm rushing to get out of there. I am, like, just crazed late. And my phone rings, and I don't recognize the number. So I just let it ring to voicemail, and this is the message that was on my phone.
Hey, Paul, it's Paul McCartney here. I'm going to ring you back in 5 minutes to do the podcast thing. I've got some time now. Otherwise, I'm going to run out of time. So if you're there in 5 minutes' time, you've got me. Okay, bye.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I retrieved that message on the streets of New York on 11th Avenue and like 53rd Street. And if you saw me from afar, I looked like, you know, these unfortunate people that have mental issues and they're like talking the voices in their head, but you only hear like one half of the conversation. That's what I looked like. Because the minute I finished hearing the message, I took my backpack and I flung it down the street screaming, "Scream! Call Paul McCartney! Idiot! Moron! Never get him back! Ah! Screen! Call!" Like, just losing my mind. So I gather myself together, and I call the number, and sure enough, somebody picks up. It's an assistant, and I go, they want to do the interview. I said, but I need, because I lied. I didn't have anything ready. My studio was in L.A. I had to get a recording line set up. And I lied to Paul when I said I was ready to do it at any time. So I call and I say, look, I need a few minutes. Tell his assistant to pull the recording line. They go, okay, but got to be quick because he's got to run out in a little bit. I'm like, okay. So I call and I say to an intern that's working at the studio where they record my podcast. I go, look, I got Paul McCartney. I need a recording line right away. And this person just out of it completely. Goes like this to me. There's somebody in the studio right now, so I don't think we can get your recording line. And I snapped and I went, did you not hear me? I said, unless you have Jesus Christ or John Lennon in that studio, get them out right now. So I call Paul McCartney's back. He's like, he's ready. I'm like, I need 5 more minutes, 10 more minutes. I had to stall Paul McCartney for 40 minutes. Calling him back repeatedly saying, I'm almost there. I finally get the line set up. I call back. They go, okay, Paul will be right out. He's in the bathroom. So now I'm picturing Paul McCartney going to the bathroom. And all I can picture is he must be a genius when he goes to the bathroom. Everything he does is genius, right? So he gets on the phone. And first thing I say to him is, well, why are you bothering me? I'm busy. I got stuff. No. So we did the interview, and this is the interview. And I got to tell you, as great a musician as he is, he's an even greater person. He could not have been nicer to me in allowing me to interview him. And then in the interview, I hope you really enjoy it. It's a big thrill for me. Here's Paul McCartney.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Paul McCartney.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm great, man.
Thank you so much for doing this. This is mind-blowing. And I know you're super busy, and I want to thank you. And among a million reasons I wanted to talk to you is that I've always been fascinated by musicians. I'm a comedian, and I have a creative process. And your creative process as a songwriter, and such a prolific one, is amazing to me. And what I've always been curious about is your evolution in terms of your persona and how you have a persona as a singular musician, but then that persona has to fit within the band persona, and how you were able to do that as a Beatle and then as part of Wings. And how does one do that as a musician?
I know, the thing is, I think it all stems from kind of when you're growing up, you know, your formative years as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I liked a lot of kinds of music. When I heard rock and roll, this was kind of special. This was now music that was special to me. It was mm-hmm. my generation's music. So I kind of liked the idea of being a musician. So I got a guitar, played around at home, did mm-hmm. a couple of little things. And then I eventually, through a friend of mine, met John.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a band already. And they asked me, about a week later, they asked me to join the band.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and so that was kind of the start of learning how to be in a band. And so I had that experience, mm-hmm. and then later on we went to Hamburg, and I had the experience of being in a band under slightly more difficult circumstances, kind of, We were living away from home. But, you know, we were teenage guys, so we loved it, really, you know.
Did you feel the pressure in Hamburg, like you're getting paid and people coming out to see you, that there was a little bit more at stake and there was more pressure then as you were moving along?
It wasn't so much like a pressure. It was kind of hard work. We played a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Being young guys, we didn't sort of want to get into something we were sort of bored with. So we actually sort of would learn loads of songs just to stop mm-hmm. from being bored. But that all stood us in good stead when we came back to record. And the man sort of said, well, what do you want to do? We said, well, I don't know. You take your choice from all of these. So that went on into the Beatles. And then, I learned there. And then going into Wings, I learned. And but you're still learning. You're learning all the time. You know, you're adapting to different circumstances. But I think the secret is you got to love what you do, you know?
Was there, going from the Beatles to Wings, was there sort of maybe self-imposed pressure, kind of like Wings is sort of, you know, you were the main thrust behind that band as opposed to sharing that load. Did you feel that? How did you deal with that, if you felt that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think with the Beatles, it was a band of equals.
Right.
And that was a great thing, but it sometimes created difficulties, which wasn't a bad thing, as I say, because you'd work through the difficulties and you'd come out with something good the other end. So, you know, having your work questioned was not necessarily a bad thing. But by the time I was in Wings, I'd kind of put all the work in with the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt now I could actually lead the band.
Right.
So that was a different thing. You know, it meant I could call the shots a lot easier. Even though in the Beatles, whoever wrote the song could call the shots.
It was more democratic with the Beatles, right? I know that one person could vote down a song and it would make... Explain that to people. I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's... It was different completely because now I was a leader of the band.
Yeah.
And so, but I had to learn that persona too, you know, and try and be kind of inclusive of the band members.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, try and think what our audience was going to want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So we mixed and matched it, you know, and eventually, around about 76, when we made the album Wings Over America, by that point, you know, we kind of had it together. We made it work, you know. That was a great thing.
Your writing process, one of the things you talked about is early on, you would write to the audience, for the audience, and then you reached the point where you stopped doing that and writing for yourself. And it's very parallel in a lot of ways to comedy, where you will initially write material, I think, when you're starting out, that's going to please the crowd, and then you start to want to write from a more personal place. A lot of great comedians mm-hmm. have done that, Richard Pryor and Lenny Bruce. Absolutely. Talk about that a little bit. Like, when did you make that turn? Is it a matter of getting enough self-confidence to go, you know what, I'm going to do this more for me and what I want to say as opposed to what I think people want to hear? And when did that turn?
I think the thing is, with everything we did and still with stuff I do now, there's never really a conscious decision to do this or that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing is, I'm just going to do it and see how it comes out. And I think as you develop, you know, at first you think, okay, I'm just going to do it now. People are going to hear these songs, so this better be something that relates to the audience. And, you know, you worry more about that at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, once you go on a bit, you think, well, I've kind of been there, done that. And now I've sort of got that out of my system. And maybe these people I'm writing for will be willing to accept something that's a little bit out of left field. Let's see. And so you try it. You know, you try a song, and you then don't worry about it being quite sort of within the same parameters as it used to be. So you try it. And then you play it to someone, and they sort of say, whoa, man, that's, you know, you're really moving forward. And then you make the record. And so it kind of happens naturally. was a natural development. We never wanted to be bored. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Beatles were just young guys who just did not. The worst thing would be we sit around and we're really bored, because we would have then had to consider whether we wanted to do this or not. So the whole trick was always trying to not bore yourself or your audience or each other. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what brought about the natural development. You were always wanting to show people the new trick.
Yeah. And you talk about you would say to Ringo or something, did you play that riff or that snare on the last track? If you did, couldn't do it. Like track to track, you were so demanding of yourselves that you'd be different. Isn't that right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we thought that we made one record and then it was like, okay, now completely clean canvas.
Yeah.
You're not going to now just go, okay, how was our last record? Let's slavishly copy it, change a few words, change the riff, and that'll do, you know. We weren't interested in that. And it was funny because we were seeing people who were doing that. Mm-hmm. There were some artists who their next record would be like their last record. And mm-hmm. we just thought, oh, man, they've wasted such an opportunity there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a blank canvas. So we always wanted to make a new mark on each and every canvas we got a chance to operate on. No, that's what happened.
And, you know, this is why I think you and the band were both brilliant and brave, because as a performer myself, you do want to, you kind of get your stuff that does well. You know, you get those jokes that you know do well, and you just keep going to that well. And you're on a world stage, and the entire world is following you and in love with you. And to have the guts to go, you know what, I know you like, you know, Hard Day's Night, but we're going Sergeant Pepper. Come with us or don't come with us. Obviously, brilliant musicians and songwriters, but fundamentally as a person in being Paul McCartney, where does that confidence come from?
Well, you know, I would say that the Beatles was a unit. And we were a unit that we'd worked together a lot. We lived in and out of each other's pockets. I mean, once when it was really cold, and the window blew out on the van, we actually like lay on top of each other in a Beatles sandwich. By that point, you're getting pretty intimate. You're knowing each other. So I think we gave each other the confidence. And as each little new canvas was painted, mm-hmm. we go, mm-hmm. oh man, that's cool. Okay, now let's do something different. So it was a natural evolution, and by the time we got fed up of touring because we couldn't really hear ourselves, it was all that was getting a bit boring, you know, at that point, because we'd worked very hard, you know, we'd work sort of over 300 days out of a year, you know, we would work. So just the toll of the sheer physical working led us to have this idea. We thought, well, let's just make a record. Let's just stop touring, go into the studio, and we'll make a record. And we'll say, well, let the record go on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so did you feel a whole new concept?
And when you were doing that, though, did you feel like you were losing, by not being able to tour, that you were losing touch in some way with your audience?
No, we didn't. I mean, we, at that point, this wasn't us being worried about our audience. This was four artists in full flow. So it was more a question of, look, the philosophy by then was, if we like it, they're going to like it.
Right.
And we had that confidence. So we just hit upon this whole sort of idea of Sergeant Pepper's, the Oscar band, the new personas, we'll have fictitious personas. We hit upon this crazy idea. And so we just went into the studio, and we were in there on and off over a period of about 6 months. And people outside, you know, the newspapers and the musical press were starting to say, oh, they've dried up. They haven't got any ideas. But we were sitting in the studio tinkering away like the Seven Dwarfs.
Right.
You know, you know, and we were tinkering away with this new stuff we were making. And we were kind of giggling, you know, when we hear they've dried up, we go, oh, no, we haven't. Wait till you hear what we're working on, you know. So it was a natural progression, and we kind of felt that what we were doing was cool. And it turned out that we lost some of the audience, mm-hmm. but then we thought, well, we gained even more. So it was a cool thing.
How was recording with George Martin to your writing process, and did that evolve over time, or was he initially from the get go a very involved fifth Beatle, if you will, which I've heard him referred to. Sorry about the PA system at the Daily Show here, but go ahead, and if you can tell me about George Martin, I'm fascinated by that relationship.
No problem, man. The thing was, George wasn't really a help in the writing. That would mm-hmm. be me, John, and later George. We would mm-hmm. do that separate from George. But when we bring it in, the production and the making of the record, he was really then a great part. So that's where the fifth Beatle kind of comes in.
For a novice like myself, what is the producer's function at that point, and what value add? I mean, obviously they're value added in the writing, in the process of making the music. What does...
Well, there were loads of little things. Yeah, there are loads of little things that, you know, you talk about dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Sometimes you don't want to cross all the T's and dot the I's. You figure you put enough in. So there would be things like that we knew we could leave with George, and we could set him tasks, you know. I remember saying, you know, we'd say, look, we love Bach, but well, we don't know how to play like Bach. You're a bit of a pianist. Mm-hmm. You know, go home and write a solo for this mm-hmm. song that mm-hmm. is, that will fit the song, but that is completely in Bach's style. So George Martin would do that. We could mm-hmm. set him those tasks. And then overall, as an overseer and the sound and the engineers, he was really good. He was good for that. You knew you had someone who was actually flying the plane.
Yeah.
So we could goofball around as much as we liked. But it's like your work, it's kind of good to have a producer of the show.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he helps. He puts it all together. And if you go home, he won't.
Yeah, exactly.
And listen, Paul,
thank
really
you,
nice
sir.
Meeting you, man. And
same here.
Fun doing a Colbert show. And so hi to all your listeners and all your folks doing this. And good luck to you, man. You take it easy.